And welcome back. Hope you all had a wonderful holiday weekend. We're going to roll right into the end of the year now together. And start off tonight by going over to London live and get our regular monthly update from Tim Refat, international geopolitical expert and analyst. And agree or disagree with Tim's view of the world, it is always provocative, and that's what we're all about. Let's say hello to Tim and see how he's doing over there. Are you up and at him, mate?
Yep, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. How was your holiday?
Lots of turkey.
Yeah, are you talking about the politicians over there or what you had for dinner?
Both.
Yes, indeed, yes. Well, what are we going to talk about first tonight? There's so many things on the table, Tim, but we're, again, sliding into the end of another dreadful year, 2007, not looking a whole lot better with Mr. Bush, the resident of the White House, talking about his surge of even more troops. They put 15,000 more in a year ago, and nothing happened except a number of attacks on Americans, probably double in that period of time. They now say that official U.S. dead, the admitted U.S. dead are approaching very close to 3,000 now. We think it's probably four times that. But be that as it may, the so-called coalition is falling apart under Bush's ever more suspect feet in Iraq. They're pulling out. The Brits are going to be pulling out. The Poles, the Italians are out or going. Not going to be much left over there except American men and women. But go ahead, Tim. Let's see how you see it.
Well, the official figures are losing three Americans a day, seven Iraqi security forces, and 93 civilians a day. And the attacks are up 22% from about a month ago. So it looks like things are getting worse and worse. So with state-mandated truth, then, of course, we have to stay in for the long term, and eventually we'll get victory by sending more troops in, because things get worse and worse, and that is a good trend. The more troops we send in, the worse it gets. So luckily, Bush and the crazy mob are going to send loads more Americans to die.
Yeah. And apparently there is a lot of discontent about that in the Pentagon and the military, who do not believe, as a group, that this is a winnable, doable situation, i.e. sending more troops in there. I think the plan may be, and as we look over our shoulder, and December isn't even finished yet, as you mentioned, three per day, already over 90 Americans admitted killed in December. That's the official number, so you can rest assured it's higher than that. But we're talking about maybe a concept that would hope that an additional 20,000 American troops would subjugate and pacify, as they used to say in Vietnam, the city of Baghdad. Now,
well, how can they do that
with the Mahdi army there is the big question.
Now, how can they pacify them when the insurgents, that's a good name for Iraqis who are freedom fighting.
We call them resistance.
Sorry?
Resistance,
yeah. Their new strategy is to use the American way and copy America, and they copied those car snipers, if you remember, in your brave city. I think it was Washington, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You had a couple of guys shooting people from a concealed car.
Yep.
And they're doing the same thing in Baghdad. They drive a distance from a checkpoint in a car. In the boot, you've got a sniper. He blasts away, and they drive off. And so the more Americans that get sent, the more sitting ducks there are going to be.
They literally are sitting ducks, and they're being picked off at apparently a dreadful rate by these car snipers. And they'll sit in the back of a small truck, a minivan, whatever, just so they can get a clear shot out of a darkened area of a vehicle. Can be 300 or 400 meters away, 500 meters away. That's a long way away.
Yeah, they're using the Russian sniper rifle.
Right, the Dragunov is the one of choice, I understand. But at any rate, yes, quite so. They even had some video on the internet taken by the Iraq resistance of Americans being killed with snipers, and it was not something that made the evening news here. I think there was one mention of it on CNN. That's all I heard about.
But yeah, but that's the problem, because your news is so state mandated that you've still got 47% of the population who think Iraq's still winnable. And that's because they haven't been given the facts. No one on your media gives them any factual concept of what the troops are fighting over there, and there is no way you can fight these snipers unless you clear the streets of all vehicles forever and have a total lockdown on the whole country forever.
Of course, this harkens back to Stalingrad, the war of the snipers. They just need an open window from 400 meters away, and that's all it takes. So it's a lose-lose situation. Interesting to read the polls about how Americans, as uninformed and dreadfully so as they are, continue to be fractionalized by this whole scenario. 47%, as you just mentioned in that one particular poll, think the situation is winnable. That's what a dreadful statistic. On the other hand, over a third of all Americans now believe the U.S. government was implicit and involved in at least allowing 9/11 to progress and taking advantage of it. So this country is seemingly more polarized than ever between people who have at least an intuitive grasp on reality and those who have bought into the propaganda, mind control, and social engineering and have nothing much else to say.
Yeah, but you're not allowed to say that over here because saying that the American government was involved in 9/11 is outside of the box and state-mandated truth, and you could be carted off as someone who's trying to incite racial hatred or psychiatric prison.
Sounds like another extension of the so-called thought crimes over there, a hate law.
Remember, in Europe, there is no free speech. It's a total neo-Stalinist state that purports to be a liberal democracy, but in Europe we've got laws that you can't discuss any history that they don't want you to. For example, the Holocaust. Irving's just been released from jail, and it's illegal to discuss history in Western Europe, and they're going to make it all across the EU. So we now have a Zionist Empire of Europe, where history is written in stone and you are forbidden by law. And remember, they stuck Irving in jail for 4 years, released him early, but they gave him 4 years for discussing the Holocaust and saying that the state-mandated truth about the figures was wrong.
He actually uttered, I think it was 10 words, and what he uttered occurred 17 years ago and was merely the actual quote from someone else's piece of writing. It wasn't even something that he said he necessarily believed in. He was quoting someone else, and he got locked up for that. What amazes me, Tim, still to this day, is how easy Europe was steamrolled by the Zionist Rothschild Empire, and you did quote it quite accurately. That's what happened there. Here are these countries, Spain, France, Germany, Belgium, with 1,000 years of history in some cases, magnificent achievements in the letters, the sciences, the arts, music, you name it. In some cases, literally the most advanced nations on the world. And all of this history, all of this nationalism, this pride of achievement, this cultural identity, this individuality, the magnificent achievements of all these countries literally were just ground up and thrown in the trash to a very large degree by a regime that has taken charge of Europe. I'm still amazed at how easily it went down.
Yeah, but remember, in America there are millions of potential criminals because you've got a right wing in your country that discusses the Holocaust and says nasty things about it, and there's, you know, millions of potential criminals ready to be locked up when the European Union Zionist laws get passed in the States.
Well, the first hate law that gets passed in the United States signals the true end of freedom here.
No, there's a problem because you've got millions of right-wing people there who...
Well, I understand what you're saying. How are you going to lock up that
guns,
many people?
Yeah. So when they pass the law, there are going to be lots of people in prison camps because I don't see that... the right wing of your country is going to sit down and let themselves be carted off to jail for saying they don't agree that 7 million Jews died in concentration camps. And like one of your leading spokesmen, who's that multi-millionaire who tries to run for the presidency and runs executive the magazine all about Harlan LaRoche?
Lyndon LaRoche.
Lyndon LaRoche. Sorry, I apologize to Mr. LaRoche. But he was in the Mirror over here, one of the gutter press, and they were saying that he's one of the worst right-wingers over there, runs a cult and is a Holocaust denier, and they're running a huge campaign against him. And if he lived in Europe, they'd love to stick him in jail.
Well, they've been smearing Lyndon LaRoche for the last 20, 25 years, and it's kind of a national pastime for some here. Hold on, be right back.
It's illegal to say what LaRoche says over here.
Right, interesting. Well, not a surprise. That's what happens when you legislate thought and speech. Can't do it. Be right back with Tim Riefath in just a couple minutes. Welcome back. Tim Riefath is with us, as he is once a month, the fourth Tuesday of each month, to give us his views on the world and how it is and is not proceeding. We shouldn't forget Germar Rudolph and, of course, Ernst Zundel, who has had over 3.5 years of his life stolen by the thought police. He is still in jail in Mannheim, Germany, undergoing a kangaroo court trial. And speaking of kangaroo courts, let us go back to Iraq now and note for our listeners who may not have heard it that the so-called Iraq High Court, the Supreme Court of Iraq, the court of puppets and dupes, has today ruled that Saddam must, in fact, be executed within the next 30 days by hanging. How do you think this is going to go down in the Arab world?
Well, they're going to make him a martyr, which is clear. And it's seen as assassination by proxy by the Bush administration. You set a very bad precedent, because now every country that the West invades knows that its leadership are going to be killed off. So we know, if we're Kim Jong-il, that we're going to be murdered. We know if we're Ahmadinejad that we're going to be murdered. We know if we're Putin and allow the westernizers into our country and the westernizers in the Kremlin to have their way, we're going to be murdered. And in Beijing, we know that if we ever let the West in, we're going to be murdered. So it sets the scene for extreme violence if any country is threatened by the West, because the leadership knows that they won't be allowed to go their merry way, take their bank accounts to away from Switzerland to a third right. state, and live happily ever after, which has been the case with Idi Amin, who lives in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, he's dead now.
But he was allowed, and
he lived out his alleged full life, whatever that was or wasn't, and died, I think, within the past year.
And he had, old Idi had heads in the fridge, according to the state-mandated truth.
Well, he's a cannibal, a murderer of at least 1 to 2 million people in Uganda, according to all accounts that I respect.
Now let's look at it from the Arab point of view. The West has killed more people than Saddam ever did.
How about this one, Tim? How about this one? I would suggest that the West has killed more people in Iraq, 1.5 million during the years of sanction, another 650, let's call it 700,000, let's say over 2 million. I would suggest that we are approaching, if not having long surpassed, the total number of Muslims that were killed during all the Crusades.
Yeah, exactly. But remember, the people we're killing aren't
fighters.
Exactly. We're killing the women and children, which
That's right.
fits in with the Rothschild and the British religion remember they're paedophile torture murderers and into Satanism. For example, over here, the biggest news was serial killing of prostitutes.
Five prostitutes. That swept the headlines.
In Suffolk. Luckily, the police have found a patsy who will be convicted, but there was a Fred West and Rose West who ran a house for runaway teenagers and were supplying these teenagers for satanic abuse, torture, murder. He was found dead, hung in his cell. His brother was going to spill the beans about how they were acting for the satanic cult that runs Britain. And he was found hung in his cell because the police arrested him for saying these things. We find that the whole of the British society, if you're going to be a chief constable or anywhere in the police, you have to be a Freemason. The Lord Lieutenant of every county, his main job is to keep the supply of these teenagers for these torture murder sects in every county. And that Prince Michael of Kent is the head of the Freemasons. So we see that this satanic cult of murdering children, which seems to be something the West does on a massive scale in Iraq, they've murdered mainly women and children, and we see it with the Israelis in the Lebanon, they killed mainly women and children, could maybe not be a coincidence, but is actually part of the secret religion of the British. They call themselves the 13th Tribe of Israel, and seem to be a satanic cult that is directed towards paedophile, torture, murder of young people. So it's just a thought that whenever the West goes into war, mainly women and children die. When Israel goes to war, they mainly attack women and children, which doesn't seem to have any military basis. It just makes the population incredibly
How many stories have we read, Tim, about women and children being shot to death and otherwise obliterated in Palestine?
And then it goes back to the prison camps in South Africa where the Boers were, the women
Lord
and children
Kitchener.
Were put to death by the British.
So we know
that the British have a long history of torturing, murdering women and children, and I'm just saying that there's something deeper and darker behind it, because the secret religion of the Rothschilds and the royal family and the higher echelons, the Freemasons, is all to do with this satanic torture murder of young people.
Well, and you folks who are in the Masons and in the so-called lower echelons, all I can suggest to you is I hear what Tim says like you. I don't have direct knowledge of it, but the more you listen and the more you read about these things, the more strange that the occult, which means secret societies, are. And certainly we do know about pedophile murder as a relatively common event here in the West, if not fact, outright common. So you have to think carefully about these things before dismissing or accepting them. That's what we're here for, to present a wide variety of information. Back in just a minute with Tim Refat live from London. We'll talk about Iran next. Back with you. For those of you trying to get to rents.com, we are momentarily down. We've been working on it for a while. They're in L.A. at the hub, as they say, trying to put things back up altogether. We're not the only site down. So, okay, we're talking with Tim Refat live in England. Tim, the drumbeat, it's almost, when you watch Bush's face and he talks about Iran, it's, I don't want to say that he doesn't have a brain, because he has some kind of a brain, but the man looks as if he is tunnel vision, one track. He's made up his mind. There's nothing going to deter him or he's been told exactly precisely what he's going to do, and he feels that God has agreed and that's what he's going to do, which seems to be mount some kind of an attack against Iran. What's your current take on the Iranian situation? The American military is certainly there in adequate strength to cause a great deal of trouble. We've talked about this for the last several years now, but what, if anything, by way of late developments, do you have for us?
Well, there's lots of developments in that they've just put sanctions on the Iranians.
Yes, right. Got the UN sanctions now. Let's talk about that first. I was going to bring that up later. I wanted to do the military first, but let's talk about the UN sanctions. Now, does this suggest that the UN Security Council is controlled by Zionism? Because it was a unanimous decision. I'm asking this quasi-rhetorically, because why would the UN Security Council vote unanimously for sanctions, and if I'm not mistaken, Russia and China are still members?
Yeah, but it suits Russia and China to have sanctions.
How so?
Because of the Russian geopolitical strategy to cause the slow collapse of the Western economy like they did to the Soviet Union via cutting them off from oil and gas supplies.
The Chinese, as you noticed, just signed another enormous deal with Iran for natural gas. I was like, well, $1 trillion deal, I think, if I remember correctly. Very big deal. So, as I said,
the Russians love sanctions for Iran because it goes with their policy of making oil and gas available.
That's right. They're moving. The Russians are moving to become almost the world's, if not the number two supplier of oil and gas in the world, and they're moving to become the world's number one supplier.
Yeah, but you must see from the Kremlin's point of view, having Iran push towards China, because China will take oil and gas no matter what sanctions are there, to boost up China and the West being unable to take oil and gas because of sanctions from Iran, means that the Europeans have to pay more and more for the oil and gas from Russia. So it's a double winner. You build up Russia economically, and Russia doesn't need to build up a huge, hyper-expensive military force. It just needs high-tech military weapons, which it launches from
its
Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, sticks into space. And if there's ever going to be a war, you've got 100 million Chinese that have gone from running fifth-generation weaponry to now state-of-the-art weaponry in a matter of 30 years.
Well, not the Chinese during the Clinton regime here, the 8 years of the Clinton regime, literally vaulted 3 decades in about 5 years. That's a very rudimentary assessment, but they made such leaps that were, of course, not technologically achieved on their own. They bought it, stole it, and otherwise took it from the American military in one way or the other.
But if you're going to build up, because Putin wants to build Russia into a first world superpower, you don't want to be burdened with draining the country dry, running a huge conventional military like America does.
No.
Because you just want high-tech military, and if there's going to be a war, then the Chinese can do the fighting because they've got 100 million men plus the arms which you sell to them, and you stand on the sidelines. So that is the strategy.
The question is, Tim, excuse me, and when I said taken from the American military, I should say the American military-industrial complex, of course. But let's talk about the actual military issues here. Are you suggesting, in your estimation, that the Russians and Chinese would essentially sit idly by and do nothing? Perhaps, well, they've sold the Iranians, we know, one of the best ground-to-air radar defensive systems in the world. But will they sit by and do next to nothing if the Israeli-pushed United States military does attack Iran?
No, they're going to make sure that the West gets crippled. So you can be sure that the North Korean Taipodong 2, which has been flown from North Korea via their transport planes will be fired, and it will have a nuclear weapon, and it will hit Britain, and will wipe the Revolutionary Guard, so they would exterminate the British race. So expect a Cobalt 60 casing on the nuclear weapon. It's as simple as that.
Hmm.
And then, of course, the Iranians get scorched, but that's better than dying like dogs like the Iraqis, or dying like dogs like the Palestinians,
or the Afghanis.
Under the occupation of the Zionists. So for them, it's a win-win situation, because Ahmadinejad and his fighters immediately get their place in heaven, and we get Cobalt 60 slowly spreading from Britain to France and Germany, and of course Russian troops would have to go into Eastern Europe on humanitarian grounds to stem the refugees and help out, etc.
Hmm.
So North Korea would be supplying the missile and the nuclear weapon, but it'd be fired from Iran. So if things get really bad, one can expect that Iran won't be without nuclear weapons, and it will have missiles which, as they said, can hit Britain, which they wish to exterminate if they're attacked. Because
explain to our listeners again the significance of your remark about Cobalt 60. Most people don't know that. We're talking about one thermonuclear weapon with Cobalt 60 casing that will ruin a lot of the Earth's surface where it's exploded
It'll just ruin mainly Western Europe, which is where you want it. Basically, you've got an atomic weapon, be it an A-bomb or an H-bomb, and you just put a cobalt container around it. Cobalt is a very hard material, so it makes a nice nose cone with a bit of ablative. And when it goes off, the atomic weapon makes the Cobalt 60 with the neutrons. The Cobalt 60 has a half-life of 100,000 years. And microparticles of the order of the polonium-10 poison we talked about will kill you, go into your lungs, bleeding from every orifice. And in France and Germany, it slowly kills the population. It's there for 100,000 years, and then you've got half left. So about 1 million years before the area affected is remotely habitable. So it's a one-shot weapon which can turn Iran or North Korea into a superpower. You don't need to fire hundreds of weapons.
It's a depleted uranium on steroids, so to speak. All right, back in just a minute with Tim Refat, live from London, as we continue. All right, Tim, it looks as if this is going to be a bumpy next year or so. I'm not sure what the timetable might be, but it would seem perhaps sooner rather than later. I don't know how you see it, but let's find out.
Well, the Iranians know when, because their translator to General Richards, the Brits who runs the 37,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan, was arrested for being an Iranian spy and passing them every single conversation Richards had. So if there's a war plan to use those 37,000 NATO troops in an attack on Iran, because Afghanistan borders Iran, then of course the Iranians will have been fully briefed by their Daniel James, who was an Iranian who has about $2 million plus worth of property, but acted as a corporal translator to this Richards and got his corporal wages, which, if he's lucky, he'll get $30,000 a year. So you can see that he was placed there by the Iranians to get the inside track. The British obviously are scared because they used 1,000 soldiers to attack Muqtada al-Sadr's police station, killing seven of Muqtada al-Sadr's officers over on Christmas Day. And it seems now that Muqtada al-Sadr and his Sadr brigade militia have been sentenced to death by the British, Rothschilds, etc., because if there's a war against Iran, which Israel has declared there will be, they're going to bomb it, and an American frigate, of course, will be blown up by the Americans or something and blame it on the Iranians as usual, then, of course, Muqtada al-Sadr will start attacking American troops en masse with his Shia militias. So they're trying to put the fear of God up him, start to clamp down, start to get at him, hopefully assassinate him before the invasion of Iran, because it's a done deal. Israel demands that Iran's nuclear establishment be destroyed. There's no way that will be allowed by the Rothschilds to develop. So the war's a done deal. The other factor is that the West is screaming it's on the verge of bankruptcy because the Russians are playing a masterful game. The fourth largest gas producer in the world, a place called Turkmenistan, a 6 million populated desert-type region, which borders Afghanistan. It's a 66-year-old dictator who called himself Turkmen Bashi and was a close friend in terms of getting huge amounts of money from Rumsfeld and your vice president Cheney, not from them personally, but they allowed large amounts of money from America to be funneled into his bank accounts.
Uh-huh.
So he would give Turkmenistan's gas to America and Britain, because remember they're running out of oil and gas in Europe. 2010, the Russians, their minister Mylov said it's either China or Europe, but not both. So the European Union's economy is on the verge of collapse come 2010. Georgia was told, we're doubling the price by Russia or we switch you off this winter. They, of course, had to pay. Georgia now has to be funded by the Rothschilds because it's a bankrupt nation.
Talk about putting the grind on them, doubling the price.
So the Ukraine now has to be funded by the Rothschilds because they're a bankrupt nation. And all the Eastern European nations are dirt poor and depending upon the EU to fund them. So they can't pay. You can see how the EU is grinding into economic collapse. Kazakhstan, there was a sort of quiet coup by the Prime Minister which failed, and the pro-Moscow president is still in power. So we've got Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran, and Russia, which basically have got all the major gas reserves in the world, the rest are tiddlers, are in the now in the pocket of the Kremlin. And the invasion of Afghanistan to take Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan's gas into Pakistan, or now via the Caspian Sea, Azerbaijan through Georgia, is a bit of a non-starter, because with Turkmenbashi dead, Turkmenistan's new government will be pro-Moscow. You mark my words on that.
Mm-hmm.
So the European Union and the Rothschilds are grinding into an economic black hole. They've been putting off this debt forever, and now it's starting to bite, and the Russians are going to collapse them economically like they did the Rothschilds did the Soviet Union. So, of course, what do the Rothschilds always go to when economic collapse is on the, not horizon, but right in front of them? They go to war. So we must attack Iran. Iran's got loads of gas and oil, and once conquered, of course, it then puts and then to the Iraqi problem, because the Shias are being supplied with weapons from Iran, and hopefully we can kill off with lots and lots of big weapons, lots and lots of Arabs, and then use our mercenaries in there to extract the oil and gas with a depleted Arab and Iranian population. So this is the result of the Russians winning the economic war and pushing the Rothschilds to the brink of financial catastrophe. Remember, the Rothschilds own the whole West. They print all your money. All the debt goes to the Rothschilds. They own the banks, etc., etc. So their little empire is on the verge of economic collapse. And if it doesn't happen, then the Western middle classes will have to lose all their money. Because remember, property is hyperinflated. And that then means that the West becomes what it really is, a small number of rich people and dirt poor, with police and military keeping the poor in the ghettos. So that's basically the decision. And the attack by Israel, brave little Israel, on Iran, which will pull in America, the real reason is that the West knows that the Russians are going to win the economic war the way they're going. And they can cause trouble in Africa so that the Rothschilds can't get anywhere in Africa. And the Chinese are giving loads of money to non-Rothschild-controlled governments, etc.
It does look like Vladimir Putin is single-handedly trying to revive Mother Russia and take on the Zionist globalists, and is doing a pretty interesting job of it so far. Now, if there is an attack on Iran, there will be dead Russian advisory staff, scientists, technicians, and so forth, probably several hundred at least, if the main reactor is taken out at Bashir. I don't know what kind of a repercussion that'll have. It'll give the Russians all kinds of room to make noise, but are they going to do anything militarily, Tim?
No, because the North Koreans from Kim Jong-il will have supplied missiles which will have atomic warheads, with one of which at least will have a cobalt casing, which will hit Britain, and Western Europe will then be poisoned from Britain.
Two things. One, Western Europe is being flooded with Muslims. In fact, the number one name for children born in male children born in all of Europe now, occupied Europe, I guess we could say, is Muhammad. So we have an interesting change over there. It's much like the hemorrhage of the United States from the South, the Latin American countries, over 70 different countries represented by the illegal invasion here. But interesting to watch is how the American military, as you've said, is being bled and bled and bled, to the extent that there is some talk of a draft, but most people don't think there'll be a draft. I don't either, because Americans, what's left of their will, would stand up and yell and scream about it. But here's the angle. The American military today announced, and something we've been talking about quietly for a long time, that they're going to begin to internationalize our armed forces by accepting, or they're talking about it. Of course, that means it's already been decided. They're talking about allowing foreign nationals to join and enlist in the American military, call it a total mercenary force. And that is what would be deployed in America's streets should martial law be declared here, not a U.N. force at all. They wouldn't need a U.N. force because the American military will be so mongrelized by then that what's left of it won't have any problem deploying in American cities.
But it isn't the American military, is it? It's the Rothschild military for the Rothschild Empire, and you must obey the people who own you.
Quite.
And if we're going to bring across Polish, Eastern European soldiers who'll work because their wages in Eastern Europe are terribly poor.
Oh, they'll leap at the opportunity.
They'll shoot dead the right wing, and if Lyndon LaRouche keeps talking, they'll stick him in jail because he's talking the way he can't talk under the... etc., etc. So you see that the Rothschilds have got it all planned. They'll use Eastern Europeans, Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, Hungarians...
Yeah, it's a very clever
Romanians,
move, though,
Bulgarians.
When you think about it. Yeah.
We've
got
loads of them in this European Union. They don't own a lot, and they'd be happy to shoot dead Americans in a new... because remember, NATO is the Rothschild puppet army for its empire. They'd be keen to shoot dead Americans on the street who wouldn't obey the new laws which would follow, you know, the EU guidelines of you're only allowed to say what history... states as written law, and you're not allowed to say anything against any grouping that controls you. So there's no talk against Zionism, no talk against anything we're talking about now. It'd be illegal.
Quite right.
It would instill hatred against the Rothschilds.
That's right. Tim, thanks for the report, as always. Fascinating to get a view from London every month with you. And we'll talk soon. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks. Happy New Year to you. Bye.
Thank you. Tim Refat. Provocative, controversial, doesn't mince words, and tells it like he sees it. All right, we'll pause and be back.
For you.
Okay, welcome back, and joining us this hour, his regular monthly appearance, Dr. Hisham Talawi, Ph.D., who has his own internet television program, very highly respected around the world, as an astute and accomplished analyst of the entire Middle East region. Welcome back, Hisham.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's my pleasure. The Christmas holiday season seems to have gone relatively peacefully in the Holy Land, as it were. Anything to report from your end?
Well, it's the first time in history that Palestinians from Jerusalem could not attend the midnight mass in Bethlehem.
They were shut out, yeah.
Because they were shut out, and as a matter of fact, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, Michael Saba, even though he had the permit, you see, this is the agony and this is the sad thing about it, is mainly the strongest countries in the world, supposedly Christian countries, but yet Christians can't reach the city or the town where Jesus was born.
That's pretty bizarre, yeah.
It is, and actually the city is surrounded with a 25-foot-high concrete wall. Israel likes to call that a fence, but as a matter of fact, it's a big wall.
One of the most hideous symbols of racism and apartheid in human history.
Definitely, definitely. And so this is basically it. There was no not much to talk about Christmas in Bethlehem this year.
Right. Okay, today in the news, the alleged news here, someone fired a rocket into Israel and wounded two Israelis. This gets prominent coverage, of course, and yet when entire Palestinian families are wiped out, it gets no coverage in the news here. Again, showing the bias of the controlled, owned, and operated Zionist-oriented American media.
Well, I mean, it's amazing. I was, before you came on in the news, they were talking about these two rockets. Most of the time, 99% of the times, these rockets don't even get close to these cities. They're basically useless rockets, and I wish if whoever is shooting these rockets would stop, because it's doing more damage.
You should just give it up. You're right. They're
exactly. It's not because Palestinians at all. It's basically damaging. Because people think, oh, well, the Palestinians can't shoot rockets. Well, these are homemade rockets. A rocket is a cylinder with a bunch of TNT in it, and you just fire it.
Correct. Very inaccurate, impossible to really aim well, and we may have lost Dr. Talawi there. Do we still have him on the line?
No, I'm here.
Oh, good. Okay, very good.
Okay.
Right, click. These rockets are absurdly useless,
yes.
Considering the inability to really exert any kind of legitimate guidance over them. They just aim and shoot and hope that you might hit something. They usually land in the fields and so forth.
Yeah.
And yet, when someone is injured, and we lament all injured people equally, doesn't matter who they are, it makes the news here. And, oh, my
right.
God, the Israelis are under attack again. You know, there we
well,
go.
I mean, the Israelis are in Palestinian cities. As a matter of fact, today they went into several cities, and when Palestinians die and their homes are
bulldozed.
Blown up to pieces, bulldozed or blown up, no one hears about it, but two rockets that supposedly is national news.
That's the point.
And also, you know, I've heard a couple of people on the Internet talking about the Vatican. I know you wanted to talk about that. Supposedly pressuring Israel.
Right. Well, Barry Chomish has been talking about this for a long time, that the Vatican...
Yeah.
Is in league with the Likud militant Zionists, and there is a deal underway to basically sell Israel out, give up control of, in terms of Israeli control, Jerusalem to the Vatican and so forth and so on. I don't know what your view on that
yeah.
is. You are certainly
well,
as close to the situation as anyone. And,
well, without hurting Chomish's feelings here, I think he needs to give it up because the information he puts out there is not accurate. The Zionists and the Vatican, they go back all the way back to 1904 when Theodore Herzl, as a matter of fact, met the Pope, and he wanted the Pope to basically support the Jewish aspirations for return to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Pope said no, because the Jews have not recognized our Lord, therefore we cannot recognize the Jewish people. And that position, basically, it was the church's position until back in 1992 when they started negotiations and they signed an agreement back in 1993. Now, the agreement they signed, just to the benefit of your audience, the listening audience, back in 1947, the United Nations partitioned Palestine into a Jewish country, a Jewish state, an Arab state, and Jerusalem was to remain an international city. The reason it was they took Jerusalem out of the formula because Jerusalem is important for a lot of people in the world, not just Jews, not just Muslims, and not just Christians, and so they decided to make it an international city with the ownership of the religious places to remain with those who owned it at that time, if it was the Christian church or if it was the Greek Orthodox or if it was whoever it was.
Uh-huh.
Now, on what we call the Temple Mount, the church, the Vatican, owns property there, like the ancient Franciscan monastery, for
right,
instance.
Right, they have forever, all right.
And they have, and that is basically what Olmert met with the Pope on the 13th of this month, as a matter of fact. And what you hear in the news, because they have agreed to give the church the to keep the ownership, because remember, Jerusalem, Israel is taking part of Bethlehem. As a matter of fact, last week they took a big chunk of Bethlehem and included it with Jerusalem. Jerusalem back in 1947 and Jerusalem today is nothing to compare. Jerusalem is taken on almost a whole state by itself because they keep adding, they keep stealing lands from the Palestinians, Christians and Muslims, and include it in what they call Greater Jerusalem. Now, the meeting last month with the Pope, basically, Olmert, promised the Pope that we're going to keep the property, the ownership of the property with the church, which is the whatever the church owns on the Temple Mount. And that's what the right-wing Zionists are having a heyday with, that Olmert is given or the Vatican is pressuring Israel.
I see.
Control of areas in Jerusalem. The fact is, Jerusalem needs to be an international city, just like it was said back in 1947. If we are to keep Christians and Muslims having free access to their religious places, otherwise, these two people, Christians and Muslims, will not be able to go to Jerusalem. As it is, they cannot go to Jerusalem right now unless you live in Jerusalem. And if you live in Jerusalem, you can't go somewhere else. Like, for instance, what we were talking about just a while ago, that Christians, the annual parade from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, it did not take place as it has been for years and years and years, hundreds of years probably.
Right.
It did not take place because now there is a complete wall surrounding Bethlehem, and people cannot go in and out unless you have a permit.
Just amazing. Yeah, just amazing. Okay. All right. So what do you expect?
And the people who were with him and his entourage, they did not allow them to go in. He went in there, did what he had to do, and came out. So it was really horrible scene to see all these Christian Palestinians pilgrims not being able to go where Jesus was born. And the crazy thing about it is you don't hear anything about it from the Christian world. It's like, forget about it. We're here. We don't need to know about Bethlehem. You know, if you don't care about Bethlehem, then might as well go hang up the Bible because, you know,
there's a very important point you make, and there was virtually no noise made over here about it, and there should have been all hell breaking loose over it. It's weird. It shows the subservience of much of the fundamentalist Christian movement in this country to Zionism, I would suggest.
I can tell you one thing. If this had been... You will see hell breaking loose in Muslim countries, voicing and speaking out against what the Israelis are doing. And I'm sorry to say, there is no voices in the Christian world to stop Israel from what it's doing. But the thing is that the Vatican is in with all these forces going to control Israel. That's nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Back with Dr. Hesham Tilawi, Ph.D., in just a couple minutes, getting his views on the current situation in the Middle East. And we'll continue with him in just a couple minutes. Back with Dr. Hesham Tilawi. Hesham, the so-called Iraq Supreme Court or High Court today upheld Saddam Hussein's death sentence, saying that he must be hanged by the neck until he is dead sometime within the next 30 days. What kind of impact, if the sentence is carried out, will that have on the Muslim world? I'm going to say Muslim world. You know, we used to say Muslim, and it became Muslim was a less elegant-sounding name, so the Western press adopted it. It's Muslim. What kind of an impact will that have on the Muslim world? And if he dies, will it incite the Sunnis to fight even harder as the primary resistance force in Iraq?
I'm not really... I thought about that question myself. Definitely, if he is killed, I don't think you will see a lot of reactions from the Muslim world or from the Sunnis or the Arab countries.
Really?
But I think you will probably see a reaction from the resistance because, remember, a lot of people in the resistance are Iraqis who don't see Saddam Hussein as he is portrayed in the Western media. And definitely we will see a lot more bloodshed in Iraq if he is hanged. I'm assuming that this is just a ploy probably to get more concessions from the resistance and probably have negotiations, because right now they are refusing to negotiate. And as a matter of fact, this is something that is not being reported in the Western media as much. There is almost another Iraq going in parallel with the Iraq we know in the news. There is an Islamic Iraq, so to speak, which is the resistance had basically established or announced the establishment of the Islamic Iraq state, the Islamic Iraqi state. So things are not going really good in Iraq. At this point, if Saddam is hanged or not, I don't think it's going to make much difference, except, you know, for a couple of weeks you might see more, you know, it would intensify the resistance.
Uh-huh.
But I really think Saddam, he's probably out of the formula now on all sides. I don't think he is...
he's expendable?
I think so, yes. Yes, I think so. So he's not... We're not talking about... yeah, I think it's... We are beyond Saddam now.
All right. Also, well, I guess it doesn't matter. Dead men tell no tales. You know what always amazed me? That Saddam, knowing what he knows about the West and the Bushes and all the rest of it, I mean, he was created by the CIA. Did not, or at least so far to date, has not gone public with his real story. One would think, one would hope, being a novelist as he was a writer of some talent, at least competent enough to write novels, he would have written his story down and made sure it was sequestered in various locations and so forth. So what do you think?
Well, that is assuming that the person we see on TV
is Saddam.
Is actually Saddam, you know? It may not be Saddam. You know, Saddam may have been, I don't know, he's probably, he might be dead, he might be in prison somewhere, he might be, this may not be the real Saddam that we see.
Hmm.
I don't know. But I can tell you, things are it's not looking good in Iraq. A lot of things that we don't see on Western media, like for instance, yesterday, the British had to go in and blow up a prison,
uh-huh.
And
yeah.
And actually arrest some of these Iraqi police officers.
Right.
And you know, Robert Gates went over there and said, we want to bring you know, instead of like take the troops, some of these troops back home, we want to bring you some more troops. I guess it's just that he wants to give the resistance more targets to shoot at.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, Iraq is a lost case. We need to do something and do something quick. We can't. All these strategies that they're trying to do in Iraq is not going to work. If we are going to have something done in Iraq, we need to force all parties to sit down. And a lot of concessions have to be taking place. But the way we're going, it's not going to happen. But like I always say, the objective in Iraq has already been met. So really, it doesn't really matter what goes on after that. The objective is break up the country into different sectarian regimes and have these regimes on each other's throats, basically
mm-hmm.
weaken the country for Israel. I always maintain that position, that the
right.
only reason we went to Iraq is to basically destroy Iraq for Israel. That's it.
No argument here. No. Mission accomplished. I guess
mission accomplished, exactly. Mission is accomplished, yes.
Yeah. The idea of propelling another 20,000 American men and women in there in uniform into Iraq, into Baghdad proper, to allegedly secure Baghdad and then pave the way for a potentially strategic withdrawal, I don't know what you'd call it, not a surrender, but to march out saying, mission accomplished here as well. We did secure the city, and we're going to leave now and turn the country over to the Iraqis. The chances of that happening with an extra 20,000, can Baghdad be secured, Hesham, with the Mahdi army of al-Sadr there?
You know, we needed about 500,000 people on the ground to maybe able to get the job done, whatever job that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, that's a big maybe, too. I agree with you.
Yeah. And what we sent in there is an expeditionary force that could not even secure Baghdad itself.
No, it's been cut to pieces in many respects. People don't even over here know about the Falcon ammo dump catastrophe, which
And
cost,
did you hear about the mutiny?
Not any more than rumors, but let's find out what you know, and we come right back in a couple minutes. We'll pause, and Dr. Hisham Talawi and I will continue with all of you in just a couple of minutes.
Statistics.
Okay, and welcome back. Talking with Dr. Hisham Talawi. What's the status of things now in southern Lebanon politically? And I guess we could take that into Palestine as well. How is Hamas doing politically? What is the sentiment of the Lebanese now? And is the cleanup continuing? I threw a lot of things out there, but
well, I think the cleanup is continuing, but the bigger question is, what is going to happen to Lebanon? And
right.
You know, at the time when Israel attacked Hezbollah in Lebanon, and well, actually, when Israel attacked Lebanon, almost destroyed the whole country. I did say at that time what Condoleezza Rice has said, that we are watching the birth pangs of a new Middle East. And I wrote an article at that time saying that, unfortunately, I'm sure they will not like the child when it's delivered, because it will not be the color of what Washington wants to see, but it will be something close to Hezbollah and Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And now Hezbollah, which is expected, and you know, they have the guns, they beat Israel in a war. And they have more guns, a lot more guns than anyone else in Lebanon. And obviously they are capitalizing on their victory against Israel. And they're asking, and that's exactly what I said. I said, we will see a government in Lebanon that is run by Hezbollah, basically, and Hezbollah's policies.
Is Hamas still a factor at all?
Well, Hamas is not a factor in Lebanon. Hamas is Hamas is a factor in Palestine.
Right, but is it still a factor?
In Palestine, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. I mean, Hamas is definitely a factor because Hamas has the government. Now, my views, Jeff, which is, it's not fair to Hamas. Mahmoud Abbas, a couple of weeks ago, he said that he would like to see new elections in Palestine. Now, is it fair to Hamas? I say no, because they won the election and it's not fair. But mm-hmm. No one has ever said that democracy was the gospel or something that came down from God. The Palestinians are under occupation. The Palestinians are dying every day. They
yeah.
are hungry. They are sick. They are in a huge prison, the wall that Israel has put around them. And we don't want to just hang on this thing called democracy, and because Hamas won the election and the whole world does not want Hamas to be in power there and taken every possible action to prevent Hamas from succeeding by cutting off funds, cutting off all assistance to the Palestinians, which... You know, you're not really hurting Hamas. You are hurting the ordinary Palestinian men, women, and children.
Well, that was my general question. Had Hamas been neutralized by all of this to any degree that it was no longer a factor? Okay.
No, it is not. But the thing is, Hamas does not need to... to just hold on power regardless if the Palestinian people as a whole are going to basically evaporate because they can't even find food to eat. I mean, people are really hungry because there's not enough food in Palestine. There's not enough money. There's no money going on. For like the last, since Hamas basically took over, employees, municipal employees, like education ministry and health ministry employees, basically the government employees have not received a paycheck yet. And the majority of the biggest employer in the Palestinian territories is the government there, the PNA, the Palestinian National Authority.
Right.
So Hamas needs to sit down and say, okay, you know, we won fairly and squarely in the election, but the world does not want us, and they are willing to basically kill our people for it. So we do need to go back to the people and have a referendum. Mm-hmm. My view on it is, yes, we should go back to the people because the world does not care about the Palestinian people, because the world does not want to see a Hamas a government succeeding. We can't just kill all the Palestinians because Hamas wants to finish off its term. I don't know if we will have Palestinians left before the end of their term. So I think they need to go back, and if they win again by the Palestinians, then we'll say, okay, that's what the Palestinian people want. But as we have talked before, Jeff, about Hamas getting the majority of seats in the parliament,
it's a misconception
when people say that Hamas overwhelmingly picked up the vote. That's not what happened. It was not a majority vote with Hamas. What happened is the Fatah, which is, you know, the other opposing party, at that time they were split up between two lists, two voting lists. And over there, you don't just vote for one particular you vote for a whole list. You know, like, yeah, you might have like 10, 15 people on the list.
I understand. Yeah.
And you just vote for that list. So Fatah had two lists. Therefore, Fatah votes were divided into those two lists, and that's why Fatah had basically did not win. Hamas picked up not because Hamas has all these people on the ground, but because the votes for Fatah were split into two, which weakened Fatah and made Hamas basically win the election.
I see.
But Hamas has like 78 seats in parliament, but that does not reflect its popularity among the Palestinians.
Okay.
That is in no way a reflection of its base within the Palestinians. And that's the problem, because for the last 35 years, Fatah has been the power over the Palestinian institutions. So all the security apparatus that the PNA has, these people were all Fatah. The people in the cabinets and the in all these departments, several departments, all these people are Fatah.
Mm-hmm.
So overnight, to bring a Hamas government and expect it to succeed in a sea full of Fatah people on top, and Hamas does not have the authority to make these people with these security agencies give up their positions for Hamas to appoint its own leaders there, or its own generals. Hamas was not even expecting to win the vote. And some of their leaders said, right after the election, they said, this is a disaster. This is going to be the end of Hamas. Hamas was not ready to be in government. Hamas was not ready to lead government. Hamas has no experience in leading government in Palestine. And that's why we are in the shape we are in.
Wow.
Because Hamas wants to continue with this, the Palestinians has to suffer. Now, is it fair for Hamas? No, but reality says if Hamas stays, Palestinians die.
Got it. That's the way it looks to me. All right, very good. Hisham, thank you for that excellent dissertation. Come right back and continue with Dr. Hisham Talawi after this.
For years, you've...
Dr. Hisham Talawi. As we have known for years, Israel has wanted a major drink of Iraq's oil, a long-term pipeline deal, and that's certainly in the works. The Iraqi puppet government is considering a brand-new oil law now that would give, big surprise, private oil companies greater control over its vast reserves. So we have private oil now bidding to purchase the cadaver of what was Iraq, basically. I don't know how this is going to play out, if it's going to play out at all. Will it work? Do you think, Hisham, is Israel going to end up with that big fat pipeline it wanted from the beginning?
Well, the pipeline has been there since the British mandate over Palestine back in the 1920s and 30s.
Correct.
And but nothing will work in Iraq unless we have a government that is able to govern. And none of these contracts or any of the stuff that goes on, it does not mean anything until we have a stable government that everyone agrees to. And the way it looks, we are going to, it's going to be quite a way from that point.
But these people in there running the government now is a joke. The average Iraqi knows it. Sure.
It's a joke. I mean, Maliki
like the government
himself,
it's like the government of Afghanistan.
Very much. Actually, the government of Afghanistan probably has more control over Afghanistan, over Kabul, than does the Iraqi government in...
over Baghdad.
Over Baghdad. I mean, just no one listens to the vice president, not the vice president, the prime minister, Maliki. And now we are seeing several voices coming out. It's going to be a mess. All I can say is it's going to be a mess because now we're seeing a lot of clashes between the American Army and the Badr Brigade, which is the al-Sadr, which is 100% supported by Iran. We're seeing a lot more of that. And as a matter of fact, the Iraqi army also got involved with that one. So we have a lot of fires all over Iraq, and it's just we can't put them out.
No way.
It's a big mess. It's a big mess. Yeah. And also we have our army is tired. You know, I don't care how strong an army is. If the army is
this army's
not
being
fighting,
bled to death, literally and physically.
If you're not fighting for a cause,
right?
What makes you get up in the morning and go to a fight if you believe in it? And none of our military personnel there believes in what we're doing there. So it's a huge morale depressant there for our...
What about this mutiny?
Well, the mutiny in the Al-Anbar province, as a matter of fact, you know, we will probably go on to see a repeat of Al-Fallujah in another city. I'm really worried about
Ramadi.
The city... of Ramadi, exactly, in Al-Anbar province. We have a whole, we have like our soldiers, the American soldiers are on their bases, and they've basically refused to go out because they have been losing members every day. And as a matter of fact, some of them have been, they would rather surrender to the resistance than going back to the bases and having to be put back again. And as a matter of fact, some of them are basically begging the resistance who, you know, we do have POWs there. We don't talk about them, but we
right.
do have them.
Sure.
And some of these guys are basically begging their captors to smuggle them outside Iraq through Turkey or, you know, going somewhere. They just want to get the heck out of there. And I don't blame them because our army is not fighting for a war that they believe in, and that's a disaster. I don't care. Like I said, I don't care how strong the army is. If you don't believe in what you're fighting for, forget it. And that's basically, we have mutinies all over the place there. And Robert Gates was, you know, he was hoping to put them down. But the thing is, he's bringing, that's where this thing about we're going to send you more troops. And the more troops, he wants to send like 20,000 or so, basically to do what we have done in Fallujah, just kill. We already in Ramadi, we kicked out some people from their own homes and took over their homes, and we got our snipers up there. And it's going to be a big mess in the next couple of days unless, you know, something happens, and I don't see anything happening in the next couple of days.
No, I don't either. The U.S. military is now doing something which may signal the end of what we traditionally know of as the American fighting machine. They are going to now, well, they're talking about possibly, which means translated, they're going to do it, invite foreign nationals to enlist in the American military, the Army, the Marines, from any country apparently, or most countries on the planet. This turns the American military into a true mercenary army and dilutes it to the extent that it could effectively be deployed against American citizens anywhere, anytime, should martial law or anything close to it be ordained or decreed or imposed upon us, because the army will not be essentially composed of young American boys and girls. They'll be foreign nationals who in many cases don't even speak English well, and they won't have any problem carrying arms against Americans.
It's funny, Jeff, that you mentioned the foreign nationals. We already have foreign nationals. We promised them green cards.
Oh, I know. A lot of Latinos in there already.
If you come join in, when you get back here, we guarantee you a green card. And the sad thing about it, Jeff, when these people die, we don't count them because they're not American citizens. So and our tally of over 3,000 now, that's the one that the
Pentagon. Oh, really? This is official policy? They don't? If these are foreign nationals serving? I see.
They're not Americans.
I get it. Well,
it's like, how many Americans died?
I
and
get
if you. If you have it, and we have a lot of people there with green cards, they don't count them either. And we have people without green cards, but they don't count them either when they die. And it's a big mess. And also, if you are injured in battle and you die a couple of days later, well, you already counted as injured and they don't count you as
I know that much. I didn't know. I thought they counted all American men in uniform, whether or not they had a green card or a driver's license from a state.
No. Well,
or a Social
they
Security
count them
card.
On they do count them on another list, but not the list that they put out.
I see. Well, we know the American dead count, no matter how you slice it, is probably three times as high as the 3,900 or 2,900 that they're claiming at 3,000.
No, actually, it went up. It's over 3,000 now.
Yeah, well, it was 90 already in December alone. I mean, this is what the admitted number of dead is. Admitted.
Yes. It's just it's a big mess.
So now they're going to begin to recruit, though, from countries, who knows, South America, Africa, Europe, Eastern European. There'll be a treasure trove of potential recruits in the Eastern European countries where they're suffering. They'll join right up and get out of there, get a possible green card to the States. Wow. So this army of ours in a few years could change complexion dramatically.
Of course. And also, we think we only have 125,000 soldiers.
We have over 130,000 contractors there.
Exactly.
Which means paid killers in most cases.
They're paid killers, and they're very highly paid killers. And as a matter of fact, some of our regular guys, they put on a few pounds so they can get out of the Army and then go back and join one of these, like, Blackwaters or...
Oh, really?
Khaki. Oh, yeah. It's going... Because, why... I mean, if I'm going to put my life
Might as well get $150,000 a year, right?
Instead of getting $2,000 a month, I'll get $15,000 a month doing basically the same job that I've been doing, and I don't have to answer to nobody when I shoot someone. Because the sad thing about it, when these contractors shoot civilians, they're not, or if they commit rape or murder or anything, no one is going to court-martial them.
No.
So basically they have a free ride in Iraq. And it's costing us a lot of money to have these people on the ground. So we probably have about 300,000 fighting Americans in Iraq. Half of them are private armies, mercenaries, basically.
I agree.
And,
so the real number is about 250,000 Americans. American agents, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. We just went over there and started a big mess in the Middle East, and now we can't even get out of there. The thing is, I said this on the show a couple of weeks ago on my show, that, it's like your son goes into your neighbor's house and burns the house down and kills few of the family there. And, you tell your son, oh, just come on over, let's just get out of that house and leave the people there to take care of themselves. And that's exactly what we've been hearing from a lot of people here in the States, that, we need to come out and just let the Iraqis handle their own stuff. And, this is, of course, probably what we need to do, but it's nonsense. Where's our responsibility? Where's our responsibility to these people? Since we admit that we messed up. We admit that we went there and there was no weapons of mass destruction. Of course, we knew all that because the main thing was to destroy Iraq for Israel. But the United States citizens need to stand up now and say, not in my name. We are going to do it right. But I don't think we have enough money to do it right, but at least let's see if we can actually do it right by bringing our people back here. We don't need our boys and girls to be in the streets of Baghdad to be killed. Bring them over here. Use our forces, finance and diplomatic sources that we have to basically get everybody in Iraq to sit down and do it right. And I think we still have enough force out there. Not militarily. We can do it militarily, but we can do it through our own resources by having these people sit down. Because everyone in Iraq has someone on the outside that is pulling his strings, even the resistance. If we can get those countries who are pulling the resistance strings to say, okay, let them sit down and talk with everybody else, it can happen. It can happen. But I don't know if it's in our strategy to make it happen, though.
There you go. There it is. That's the punchline. Thank you, my friend. We'll talk again in the new year. Happy New Year to you. I appreciate your expertise and your wisdom and your analysis always. Thank you, Hisham.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, good night. Dr. Hisham Talawi, PhD. And we'll pause and be right back.